Welcome to the Word Theater Short Story Podcast, your weekly access to the best short stories read by great actors, recorded live in the U.S. and the U.K. This is Cedaring Fox, Word Theater founder and artistic director.
And I'm Kirsty Peer, U.K. fan and creative partner.
Today we bring you a story by a dear friend to Word Theater, the late, supremely gifted author Brad Watson. Nikki Michaud performed Vacuum in Los Angeles the first time we featured Brad's stories at Word Theater. He and his wife traveled from Wyoming to Los Angeles to be there for the reading. Suffice it to say, we became very good friends that day. Brad's passing came as quite a shock, but we are truly grateful that his work is here forever. This story, Vacuum, is a poignant comedy of childhood, and you will hear how brilliantly Brad has captured the innocent aims of youth when good intentions go awry. To introduce Vacuum, please welcome Nikki Michaud.
Hi, this is Nikki Michaud. I loved meeting the author, Brad Watson, and he left us way too soon. He was such a wonderful, engaging, and dynamic writer, painting such a vivid world. And I had so much fun reading this story, doing all these voices. I hope you enjoy the story as much as I did.
The mother told the boys that she was much unappreciated in this house. She was just like a slave. She pushed the vacuum cleaner back and forth on the floor at their feet where they sat on the sofa. They had been trying to watch a Western show on the black and white television before she had turned the vacuum on and began to shout her words over its howling motor. "I am the only one who does anything around here," she shouted, yanking the vacuum cleaner back and forth. "I cook, I clean, I wash, I go to work and bring home what little money we have, and nobody helps. I'm just like a slave, but I'll tell you one thing," and she turned the vacuum cleaner off. Over whose howl the boys had heard nothing, but just had sat there watching her bewildering expressions, her wide eyes, her wide open mouth. "One of these days, I'm going to walk out this house and never come back." The mother let the vacuum cleaner handle fall to the floor with a bang, and she stomped into the kitchen where she had been frying a chicken. The boys really wanted to see what was going to happen in the Western show, but now they had missed it because they had been watching their mother make faces and then yell that one day she would walk out of the house and never come back. And then they stopped watching the commercial that was coming on because they heard a banging and a clatter and a loud hissing sound in the kitchen and saw a large cloud of steam and smoke because the mother had burned her chicken, dumped her pan into the sink, and now she came stomping past them toward the back of the house saying they could eat whatever they wanted. She didn't care. The boys went outside in the gloaming while mosquitoes whined around their bare shoulders and talked about how they could keep their mother from walking out of there one day and never coming back. The youngest boy said they could trap her in her room because that's what the oldest brothers did to him whenever they didn't want him to follow them or get in their way. The oldest brother called him a moron and said they couldn't trap their mother in her room because she was a grown-up and grown-ups couldn't be trapped in their rooms by their own boys. The middle brother said the point was that they wanted to keep their mother, not lock her away from them because she was a pest, which was why they would sometimes lock up the youngest brother. "I mean, yeah, she wouldn't be able to get away," he said, "but that's not the point." The oldest brother said, "All right, you're both morons." Then the middle brother suggested they get one of the other family's maids to come down and help with some of the household chores in their house and make it easier on their mother. The older brother thought about this for a second, then said, "What are we going to pay them with?" "If it was Rosie," the middle brother said, "we could pay her in dirt." All the brothers knew the harbor's maid Rosie was a dirt eater, and so they considered this solution for long enough to decide that they would sleep on it. They went back into the house, which had chicken oil smoke hanging up around the ceiling, and made themselves bologna sandwiches on white bread with lots of salad dressing mayonnaise, and ate them in front of the television and went to bed at a reasonable hour, as that seemed the honorable thing to do. From the crack between their mother's bedroom door and the flooring, there came a steady, drifting wisp of cigarette smoke and the sounds of muttering and weeping as they filed by to their own rooms in the rear of the house and went to bed. It was summertime, and the next morning after the mother went to work, the boys pulled on a pair of shorts and crossed the street to the vacant lot and dug some premium blue-veined hard clay out of it and put about a dozen good waxy chunks into a paper sack. Then they walked up the hill to the harvest house to see the maid, Rosie, about their proposition. One of the harbor twins, Derek, was in the side yard in the sandbox digging a hole. He was far too old to be playing in a sandbox, but they knew better than to ask him about it because he wasn't playing. He was digging a hole as if to excavate the sandbox. What do you want? He said to the boys. We want to talk to Miss Rosie about some chores, the youngest brother said. Tell her about whatever you want, the harbor twins said. But don't call her Miss Rosie. Why not? Because she's a nigger, the harbor twins said. You don't call a nigger woman Miss, you idiot. He's right, said the oldest brother. If you had a maid, you'd know that, the harbor twins said. We had a maid, the middle brother said. Shut up, the oldest brother said. That's right, the harbor twin said. And then your old man knocked her up and got sued and almost got the nigger maid hung by the Ku Klux Klan and got cut in the gizzard by the nigger maid's nigger lover who had to run off or get hung by the Ku Klux Klan and lost his job and ran off. He didn't run off, the middle brother said. Shut up, the oldest brother said. He didn't run off, the middle brother said. He's a traveling salesman. He sure is, the harbor twin said. The boys knocked on the carport entrance to the harbor's house, the door that went straight into the kitchen, which is where they knew Rosie was most likely to be, unless she was off in the house somewhere vacuuming. She was at the kitchen window doing something and saw them before she even heard a knock, and they saw her face brighten like it always did when she saw them. Rosie had been their maid before their father had fired her in order to hire the younger, prettier maid who he had then knocked up and all the trouble started. But Rosie didn't hold it against the boys. My babies, she said, swinging their wide kitchen door. Come on in this house. What you doing coming to see me? She said this as if she were getting on to them, like, did she get on to you about it? But they could tell she was still very happy to see them. Rosie was stout, but not round except in her face. She was tall and kept her hair back in a tight little bun and wore a clean maid's uniform with a white collar. She had flat feet, you could see, because when she worked around the house, she liked to go barefoot, and the pink flat soles of her long feet slapped against the cool linoleum and hardwood floors. The middle brother remembered once when he asked her about it, she'd said, I like cool feet. We brought you some dirt, the middle brother said, handing her the sack. I see, Rosie said, looking into the sack. Some of that good dirt from the bank across the street from your house by them blackberry bushes. Yes, ma'am, said the middle brother. The older brother popped him hard between his shoulder blades and he shut up. We were wondering if you wouldn't come down to our house and help out a little bit, the oldest brother said then. Rosie, who had been peering again into the sack of dirt, looked up and raised an eyebrow. I don't know if I know what you mean since your daddy fired me 2 years back and hired that trash to come in and take my place. Well, you better be careful now, as it was clear she was getting her dander up. Mama's been having a hard time with having to work her job at the clinic and clean the house and cook supper and all that, the middle brother said. We were just hoping we could get her a little help at it. Rosie frowned and looked into the sack of full dirt again. She was maybe thinking that if she had to go to work and then go home and do those things, then why couldn't that white woman go to work and then go home and do those things? If her children had to help out with the chores and around the house while she was at work, then why couldn't that white woman's children help out with the chores while she was at work? She might have said those things outright out loud if she thought anybody would have listened. And if she didn't have a soft spot for these boys because she practically raised them, she was about to say something when the little brother said something. He said, Rosie, are you a nigger? Rosie's face changed and pulled into itself and her eyes flashed. What? She said, what did you say? She was looking at the youngest brother and then at all three of them like she had never seen them before and was mystified. And if they hadn't been so mystified themselves by the expression on her face, they might have been smart enough to leave right away. But they weren't, or they were mystified.
I said,
the youngest brother said, before the other two brothers, still mystified and too stunned to act quickly, could stop him.
Are you a nigger?
I'm not a nigger, Rosie said. Niggers is dogs. Don't you come in here calling me a nigger. She began to straighten up her kitchen by throwing some things into the kitchen sink and some things from the drainer back into the cabinet, making a loud clatter and banging. I tell you what, she went on, you can get your lazy good-for-nothing selves out of this house and back down there where you want me to come do them chores yourself. My children would never sit around while they mama did all the work. Did? They wouldn't be sitting for a long time. I'd wear them out so good. You get on. The boys had not moved while she spoke to them and banged around, but when she stopped for a moment, they began to sidle out of the harbor's kitchen door. As they were going out, Rosie said to the middle brother, I can see them other two being like that, but not you. I thought you had better sense than that. The middle brother, who wished she wouldn't do that because he hated being the goody-goody and she was making him like the goody-goody again, said, well, I don't. You can all get on out of here then, she said. We will, they said. And you can take this dirt, she said. I don't want it. I don't need your dirt. She stood there shaking the paper bag at them, but the boys ignored her and kept walking. Shut up, Rosie, said the harbor twin who had been standing with his shovel in the sandbox watching all this. Don't you tell me to shut up, youngin, Rosie said. I will if I want to, the harbor twin said. You just wait till your daddy gets home, Rosie said. And after that, the boys paid no more attention and were soon out of earshot back down the street. Way to go, Igmo, the oldest brother said to the youngest brother. That night, when the boy's mother came home from work again, she was not mad like the night before, but she still looked swollen face and didn't say much while she cooked a pound of bacon and made them bacon and tomato sandwiches on white bread with salad dressing mayonnaise. And she still cut them all into triangle halves and stacked them on a plate where she set them down in the middle of the table. Then she asked the middle brother to say the blessing. And after that, they played the game where they all sat there waiting for her to say go before they started grabbing sandwich halves and eating them as fast as they could. The mother didn't eat any of the sandwiches herself, though, and went to her bedroom again as soon as she'd done the dishes and shut the door. The next day, the boys decided to try something else. The only other person they could go to for advice was old Dr. Horngay up on the street who was retired from the charity hospital. Every other grown-up who lived on the street was either at work or a colored maid or a white woman's friend of their mother's. They couldn't ask help of their mother's white woman friends because it might make their mother ashamed and Dr. Horngay might have some old medicine lying around. That would make their mother feel better. So they waited until Dr. Horngay had time to get up and about. Then they went up there, knocked on the door to the den from the carport. In a minute, the door cracked open and Dr. Horngay's white bearded face appeared in the crack, wearing a pair of one-arm spectacles on his red and blue nose that was the shape of a deformed, dried-out potato. His white hair was flattened in some places and pointed out straight in others. What can I do for you boys? He finally said. We know you're not a doctor anymore, the oldest brother said. We thought you might have some old medicine left laying around. Once a doctor, always a doctor, Dr. Horngay said, and he coughed. He opened the door on up and stood there in it, wearing an old cracked pair of leather slippers on his white feet, a stinking-looking pair of pajama bottoms, and a tartan robe that had no belt. He fished a non-filter Camel from a package in the breast pocket of the robe and lit it with a match from a book of matches and blew a cloud of smoke out over their heads where they stood at the carport looking up at him. The boys were astonished at the amount of gray and white speckled hair on his stomach and chest. It was like he was wearing squirrel pelts there or something. It was hard not to stare. The middle brother looked past Dr. Horngay into the den. He was hoping for a sight of Dr. Horngay's wife, who no one had seen in years because, word was, Dr. Horngay's wife was ridden down by sadness and an extra 150 pounds and no longer came up out of their basement. The only thing the middle brother could see in the den was a stretched out lazy boy, and on the headrest of which lay a scrawny yellow cat looking right back at him. It gave him the creeps. What would you need medicine for? Dr. Horngay said then, scratching at those squirrel pelts. The brothers told them they needed it for their mother, who was afflicted with sadness and rage and who was threatening to walk out of their house and never come back. Is there a medicine for that? The youngest brother said. Plenty, Dr. Horngay said. He laughed as if to himself. Oh, yeah. Lots of tinctures and remedies for that malady. What time does your mama get off from work? About 5, the middle brother said. I'll be down at 6, Dr. Horngay said, and he closed the door gently in their faces. I don't know, the middle brother said as they walked back down to their house. If he can't do anything to help his own wife, how's he going to help her? Meaning their mother. The only thing wrong with Dr. Horngay's old fat wife is that she's a drunk, the oldest brother said. Who told you that? The middle brother said. Everybody knows that, the oldest brother said. Yigmo.
Yeah, the youngest brother said. You did not know that, the middle brother said to him. I did too, the youngest brother said. You Yigmo.
That afternoon, when the mother came home, the boys were all three sitting in a row on the sofa in the den with their hair combed, their shirt tails tucked in, their shoes on and their shoelaces tied. My goodness, their mother said, to what do I owe the honor? The boys smiled at her and kept their mouths shut. She stopped where she was, standing beside the kitchen table, holding the sack of groceries she'd picked up on the way home from work and looked at them. What are y'all up to? She said then. Nothing, the oldest brother said. The middle brother and the youngest brother shook their heads and said nothing. The mother set the bag of groceries carefully down on the kitchen counter as if its contents were fragile and looked at the boys as if they were hiding something like a bomb or a stray cat or a snake or somewhere in their clothing. And with that expression on her face and her jaw cocked in curiosity and awareness, she walked past them, looking at them sideways, and went down the hallway to her bedroom to do whatever she did before she got started on cooking their supper. One thing they knew she did was change out of her nurse's uniform and put on regular clothes. And maybe pee. She wore a crisp white nurse's uniform, even though she was not a nurse, but she worked in the pediatric clinic as one of the ladies at the reception station and did some kind of paperwork in the back office area behind the reception station. The boys just figured that the doctors at the pediatric clinic liked for all the ladies who worked there to look like nurses, whether they were nurses or not. They didn't know why the doctors might want it that way, but on the other hand, it seemed to make kind of sense, though they couldn't just say what kind of sense it might be. That was for the grown-ups, and they didn't really have to worry about it or think about it, and so they didn't. The mother came back into the den and stopped short when she saw that the boys were still sitting on the sofa where they had been sitting when she got home. She folded her arms and looked at them for a few seconds before saying, I know something's up. What have you done? What's wrong? Nothing's wrong. I promise, the oldest brother said. The other two brothers kept their mouths shut as they had agreed to do. And after looking at them suspiciously for another long minute, the mother turned and walked slowly into the kitchen as if thinking. She was most likely thinking that one or another of the boys had had some kind of accident, that maybe they had broken the window she hadn't noticed yet, or destroyed the mechanisms inside an appliance, or gotten caught stealing something or destroying something somewhere else, and were therefore waiting either to tell her about it or to be visited by the injured party, coming to inform her that because of what her boys had done that day, she must pay them a certain sum of money in order to repair or replace what was missing or destroyed. And then she looked out the window and saw Dr. Horngay walking up their driveway into the carport, carrying a bunch of flowers and a bottle of something inside a paper sack, and wearing a suit and tie. Oh, God, she said to herself, and then louder she said to the boys, what did you do to Dr. Horngay? When she heard nothing, she looked over at the sofa. The boys were still sitting there and staring at her as if they were not only mute but deaf, or like dogs being spoken to and unsure what the tone of the person's words meant. That clap mouth, momentary, attentive interim between daydreaming and the next distraction. Or like children in the convenience store who, having just slipped candy bars into their pockets, were looking at the clerk with expressions that were the most balanced and perfect combination of innocence and guilt. The mother was fairly mystified between the looks on her boys' faces and the appearance of Dr. Horngay in her carport, now at her carport side door, the den door, and ringing the bell, and dressed in a suit and tie, and carrying a bunch of flowers and a bottle of something inside a paper. Oh, she felt a strange, unintelligible flutter of panic.
What have you done? She said to the boys, who did not hear this because she said it in a voice just barely above a whisper. When she opened the door, Dr. Horngay stepped back from it with flowers and bottle in his hand and made a deep bow. Good evening, my dear, Dr. Horngay said. You look as lovely as ever. It's been far too long since we've had the pleasure of your company. Their mother did not open the screen door, but said through it, Hello, Dr. Horngay, what can I do for you? For me, Dr. Horngay said and laughed to himself, looking off toward the street and heaving a sigh as if he was suddenly a little pleasantly saddened by something. Maybe the thought of how he'd never gotten rich like the doctors their mother worked for down at the pediatric clinic, or how his wife had gotten so sad that she'd gained 150 pounds and moved into their basement and now couldn't get out. Or how he himself couldn't go anywhere now since the police had taken away his driver's license after he'd run into a telephone pole on the way home from the Travelers Club out on the highway. Or maybe it was something way back, whatever it was he had done that had banished him to the charity hospital in the first place. Madame, you need do nothing for me, Dr. Horngay finally said after his long and melancholy pause. The question is, what can I do for you? For me, their mother said. I'm sorry, Dr. Horngay, but there's nothing wrong with me. No, Dr. Horngay said, looking surprised and most perplexed, but in a playful way. Well, your fine boy's there, and he gestured with the hand that held the bottle and the paper sack toward the brothers, still sitting on the sofa in the den behind her. Those precocious, compassionate young men of yours. Said that you were afflicted with a grievous sadness, and I, madame, am the doctor here to cheer you up. Their mother then turned a look on the brothers, still sitting very still on the sofa, that they had never seen before. The look was so thrillingly unfamiliar and so deliciously terrifying that it was all they could do not to yelp and cower or leap off the sofa and run out into the yard. But they were, in effect, paralyzed by the look and remained very still. And only their expressions changed from attentive curiosity and expectation to attentive and paralyzed panic delight. May I be so bold, Dr. Horngay said then, and he opened the screen door with a little finger of the hand holding the bottle in the paper sack and held the flowers toward their mother with the other hand. Their mother took the flowers and said thank you in a voice that was neither here nor there in terms of being grateful and pleased or puzzled and annoyed. And then she said, what's in the sack? Only some of the finest bourbon made in the great state of Southern Kentucky, Dr. Horngay said. And with a flourish, he removed from the sack by its neck a bottle of Old Crow whiskey. Oh, my, it's been a long time since I've had a drink or anything like that, their mother said. The boys knew this was true, that the only person drinking anything like that around their house for the last few months before their father left for his job as a long-haul traveling salesman was their father himself. And sometimes, during the daytime when she was supposed to be washing or ironing or vacuuming the house and watching them, the good-looking young maid who would soon enough cause so much trouble for herself and everyone else. They knew that the only thing to drink around the house nowadays was their mother's jug of kosher manischewitz, which she rarely sampled and which she kept not because she was Jewish, she was raised Methodist, but because it was the only wine around their town that wasn't wino wine like Boone's Farm or that other one that you often saw actual winos clutching as they staggered down the street or lay in the gutter behind Woolworths downtown until the police found them and hauled them down to the pokey to sleep it off and then work it off, sweeping the very gutters they had passed out in the day before. Too long, madame, too long, Dr. Horngay said, gently slipping past that mother into the den and giving the boys a nod and a wink where they sat on the sofa. He made his way to the little dining table just outside the kitchen where they ate most of their meals. The bigger, nicer table where they ate the special meals like Thanksgiving and Christmas was in the formal dining room, which also had a fancy sofa and two fancy stuffed chairs and a hi-fi, but which was almost never used or even entered in order to keep it clean and neat for the next special occasion. All the houses on their street, a cul-de-sac that had been until then a little dirt road down to a small lake in the woods on the northern edge of town, had been built by the same builder around the same time, and they all had the same setup, with the den being the room that most people hung out around in, and the living room, in which almost no one ever actually lived. It was one of the small, curious things about the world into which the boys had been born. "I'll have a drink with you," their mother was saying to Dr. Horngay, who had helped himself to a couple of small glasses from the cupboard and some ice from the freezer atop the refrigerator, and set the glasses of ice and the bottle of Old Crow down on the little dining table. She said, "I'll have a drink, but then I have to cook supper." "Oh, pish posh," Dr. Horngay said with a courtly gesture of one hand. "I'd be willing to wager that these boys would love to have a simple repast, something we could order over the telephone, my treat," he said. Turning to the boys sitting on the sofa, he said, "Boys, tell me if I'm wrong, but I'd be willing to wager that you wouldn't turn down a sack of Mrs. Benson's hot tamales. Am I correct?" "Yes, you are. You bet," the boys said, piping up and sticking their spots on the sofa as if glued by their pants. The mother said she would think about it while she had her drink with Dr. Horngay, and in the meantime, she allowed the boys to watch television. The oldest boy got up and turned on the set, and they began watching a different episode of the same Western they had been watching the day their mother had become upset. At first, they partly watched the Western and partly watched their mother and Dr. Horngay having a drink and talking. Then Dr. Horngay offered their mother one of his Camel cigarettes, and they both began to smoke along with their drinking and talking. And Dr. Horngay was offering to call in an order to Mrs. Benson for the hot tamales, but pouring himself and their mother more drinks first, and the boys became more distracted by the Western. Dr. Horngay and their mother were becoming louder and were laughing a lot, and the smoke from their cigarettes was creating a beautiful haze of gently swirling blue smoke in the hanging lamp above the little dining table. But all of this had moved into that part of the boys' brains that resembled the waking equivalent of a dream, there but not there, attached but to somewhat removed from their primary consciousness. This is something that often happened to them in school or church or while watching something unfathomable on television, such as the evening news. But now it was eminently fathomable Western program they were watching, whereas the little get-together of their mother and Dr. Horngay, although engineered by themselves, had become unfathomable and thereby had been relegated to the nonverbal part of their brains. Outside the big sliding glass door beside the dining table where their mother and Dr. Horngay sat drinking and smoking and talking and laughing, the darkly silver gloomy began to creep again into the sky. The greens of the grass and the unkempt shrubbery on the hill behind the house also darkened softly. In the den, in the failing light outside the penumbra of the hanging lamp where their mother and Dr. Horngay sat, the animated light from the television set trembled, flickered, and leapt about the room. "Ooh, damn," the oldest brother whispered to the others, all three of them with their eyes on the Western program. "How does he jump off the top of a house like that and land on the horse and not rack his balls?" "I don't see how," the youngest brother said. "You don't even have balls yet," the oldest brother said.
"I do too."
"I could see how he could do it," the middle brother said. "Bull," the oldest brother said. "I do. It's all in how you land. You have to land with your legs squeezed up and your back on your butt a little bit." "Slightly," the oldest brother said. "You're so full of crap." "I'll show you," the middle brother said. "Stay in the yard. Don't wander up off the street," their mother called as they filed out the carport door. The oldest brother helped the middle brother extract their old rocky horse, which was actually a springy horse, from the storage room built just off the carport and set it up in the grass just below the lowest overhang on the roof. Then the oldest brother helped the middle brother up onto the eave by cupping his palms together and boosting the middle brother's foot. And the middle brother was half tossed, half self-hoisted up onto the roof. And he turned and squatted and looked down at the faces of his older brother and younger brother, where they stood on either side of the springy horse, looking up at him in the softly failing light. He knew, all of a sudden, what a fool he was. How badly hurt he was going to be if he made the leap onto the back of the springy horse from where he now squatted on the roof. His first idea upon knowing this was to leap and pretend to miss the horse, and maybe he would only twist his ankle. Then his second idea was to suggest that the youngest brother try it first, since he didn't have balls yet, not really anyway. And the oldest brother and the middle brother could also check the youngest brother's landing when he arrived at the plastic saddle of the springy horse and control it all. And then he thought he would cry because he was flooded once again for the first time in a long time with the shameful memory of something he had done to the youngest brother one time when they were being watched by Rosie, back when she was their maid and the oldest brother was in school, but the middle and the youngest brother were still both too young to be in school. It was a warm afternoon and they were all three out in the yard, the two brothers in shorts with no shoes or shirts, and Rosie, who sat on the low retaining wall between their yard and the next, while the youngest brother and the middle brother played in the grass nearby. Rosie, who wore a maid's uniform that was not unlike their mother's nurse's uniform, except it was blue instead of white, was reading the newspaper where she sat on the retaining wall a few feet away. Looking down into the thick St. Augustine grass, the middle brother spied something gleaming and picked it up. It was a toy razor blade, double-edged. He knew it was a toy razor blade because it was so easy to bend back and forth. "Look," he announced, "I found a toy razor blade." Rosie, biting at a fingernail, glanced over at him and wrinkled her brow. She was trying to finish something she was reading in the newspaper and didn't really want to be disturbed in order to deal with some foolishness on his part. "Put that thing down," she said, "before you hurt yourself." "I can't hurt myself," the middle brother said. "It's a toy." "It's not a toy," Rosie said. "It's a razor blade, youngin. You put it down." "It is not a real razor blade," the middle brother said. "I'll prove it." He walked over to the youngest brother, who had been niggling with his finger at a worm on a roly-poly in the grass, not hearing any of this, and he ran the edge of the razor blade down the length of the youngest brother's sun-brown, naked back, following the bumpy line of the youngest brother's spine. A bright red line of blood jumped from his brother's back and began to bead and run down in crooked trails. The middle brother dropped the razor blade and stepped back, and he screamed just as Rosie dropped her newspaper and began to shout. And a moment later, the youngest brother, turning in a circle like a dog after his tail and trying to see what had happened to his back that was making everyone scream and shout, began to scream and cry. The middle brother fell down into the grass, bawling and striking the ground with his fist, blubbering out, "I didn't mean it. I didn't mean it. I thought it was a toy." Remembering this, now as he squatted on the roof, looking down into the younger brother's irritating but inarguably innocent face, the middle brother felt the same terrible wave of shame he'd felt just after slicing open the youngest brother's back 3 whole years before. And he also felt a heartbreaking longing also for the presence of Rosie, who had been such a comforting maid because she was never been afflicted with sadness and had always been cheerful except when she was mad, and she was never mad for longer than it took her to get her madness out, and then she was always and ever her regular self again, and it had always brightened his spirits to see how she could be such a normal person, even though she was colored, even though a maid, even though he knew quite well she must miss her own children while she spent her whole day long there taking care of them, him and his brothers who didn't appreciate her at all. And now, just today, they had called her a nigger. He might as well have said it, too. The only thing he could do now was to jump. He landed perfectly, which didn't make any difference because two of those springs suspending the horse in his frame snapped, and the belly of the horse hit the ground. His mouth banged into the horse's flat-flowing plastic mane, and he bounced off the horse to one side of his mouth, though immediately flowing with blood. Didn't hurt much because very possibly he thought for the moment he had before the pain occluded all thought, he had broken every bone in his butt and his back. After a moment, he lay in the cool grass in what was now once again the glooming and began to scream. The youngest brother began to scream too out of his own terror. He ran in a tight circle for a moment, screaming, and then he ran back around to the house and up the steps and ran smack into the sliding glass door, on the other side of which their mother and Dr. Horngay looked up from the dining table in surprise. "Good God," Dr. Horngay said, standing up. Their mother had already dashed over to the sliding glass door, frightened but angry, with the incredulity of one who has suffered too often too long the reckless, mindless behavior of boys. She muttered, "What in the world? What in the world?" over and over to herself. She knelt beside the youngest brother, who, stunned from running into the sliding glass door, lay on his back on the patio with his eyes wide open. But when the mother leaned over him and said, "Are you okay?" he began to scream again and point frantically in the direction of his brothers around the side of the house. When the mother and Dr. Horngay came around there, the mother holding the youngest brother in her arms, the oldest brother said, "He jumped off the roof onto the rocky horse. I told him not to." The oldest brother stood off to one side in order to detach himself from any semblance of blame. The mother screamed then and set the youngest brother down hard enough in her haste to set him crying too. And she began to shout to Dr. Horngay, "Help! Help! Has he broken his back? Oh my God!" Don't move, son, Dr. Horncase said. Just lie still there now. Can you feel this? After a moment, having managed to stop screaming himself, the middle brother began to come back into this world, into the shooting, searing pain in his butt, in his back, the throbbing pain in his mouth, into the frightening vision of Dr. Horngate's horrible nose just inches from his own face, into the hot, overwhelming odor of the whiskey and the cigarettes on Dr. Horngate's breath, and finally into the strange and tickly sensation of Dr. Horngate's fingers wiggling and pinching at one of his toes. He nodded his head. Then Dr. Nahorngay was feeling at his neck and along the bones of his spine and saying, he's going to be all right, I believe. And he could hear the sounds of his mother weeping and saying, oh, when will it stop? And then, kind of like in the distance, a car pulling into the drive, headlights glancing against the whole odd scene. And then there was their father standing above him, seeming impossibly tall and saying, I got a message over in Vicksburg, said it was something from Rosie. He looked from the middle brother to the busted Rocky Horse to the mother and to Dr. Horngay, standing up right now a little wobbly and attempting to straighten his jacket and tie. The father said, what in the goddamn hell is going on? The middle brother started to cry as if his heart were broken, as indeed it was. And he burbled out, we were supposed to get a sack full of hot tamales. And then the youngest brother began to wail. And the oldest brother broke into choking sobs he was trying to hold back. The father looked around at all of them strangely. Dr. Horngay said, your son attempted apparently to leap from the roof onto this contraption. However, after what I concede was merely a superficial examination, I do believe the boy will be fine, aside from bruises, a busted lip, and possibly some slight injury to his tailbone. And now I'm sure you'll have no more need of my attention, so I should get back to the house and check on my beloved Eustace, who, as I'm sure you know, has not been well for some time. Holding himself fairly erect, Dr. Horngay made a little bow with his head, adjusted his eyeglasses. He turned and walked into and through the deepening twilight of the neighbor's yard, a listing specter, emerged on the other side, and followed his grainy shadow from the street lamp flickering out front of their house up the hill towards his own. The father carried the middle brother into the house and laid him down on the sofa where the boys had been sitting all afternoon. And he said a proper hello to the two other brothers. And then he kind of hugged their mother, who was sniffling but getting a hold of herself. And the two of them spoke quietly together for a few minutes. But soon they began to speak in normal volume voices. And then, when the father noticed the bottle of Old Crow on the table with two glasses half filled with melting ice, their words got louder. And the father was saying things about what was she doing down here drinking whiskey with that old pervert while his boys were outside with no parental supervision and they could have been killed. And she was saying things how he had some nerve lecturing her about responsibility. And then he was making himself a tall drink from Dr. Horngay's bottle of Old Crow. And they continued to argue. And at one point, finally, the father slammed his empty glass down on the kitchen counter and said, well, I'll be damned if that pathetic son of a bitch is going to come sniffing after my wife, separated or not. And he stormed out the carport door. And the mother stormed through the den into the back of the house, saying not quite under her breath, oh, my fucking God. The oldest brother and the youngest brother immediately ran out of the house to see what their father was going to do to Dr. Horngay. And though he didn't feel very good and was very sore in his back and butt, the middle brother got up off the couch and limped after them up the hill calling, wait for me! Up at Dr. Horngay's house, from the light of the street lamp at the edge of the yard, they saw their father in Dr. Horngay's carport pounding on the door to Dr. Horngay's den and shouting, open this goddamn door, Horngay! And then he came out of the carport and stepped into the shrubbery in the bed beneath the picture window that looked out from Dr. Horngay's living room and pounded on the glass with the same fist and shouted some more for Dr. Horngay to get his ass out there right now. When Dr. Horngay still did not come out, their father walked to the street and dislodged a piece of asphalt from his edge and stepped back into the yard and was about to heave it toward the picture window when the front door from the living room opened and Dr. Horngay stepped out onto the shadow of the little stoop there with a rifle of some kind in his hands. No. You step back, sir, he called to their father.
Their father, the piece of asphalt in his hand, did indeed step back a step and stared at Dr. Horngave with the gun in his hands. "Run home, boys," their father said to them. But they only scurried out into the street and then across the street into the harbor's yard and stopped there. Then their father said, "Shit, that's only a BB gun, you damn fool." And he started toward Dr. Horngate. Dr. Horngate lifted the BB gun to his shoulder and began to fire and slide and pump and fire again, demonstrating what seemed to the boys a remarkable facility with the BB gun. An example they will remember the next time they had a BB gun war with the other boys on the street. The Harbor twins had a daisy pump, just like the one Dr. Horngate was shooting their father with right now. Their father began to shout out in pain as the beanies from Dr. Horngate's daisy punch pinged off his body until finally he retreated into the street, where Dr. Horngate got him a few more times until the father and the boys all retreated all the way down the hill back into their own carport and into the house. The boys sat on the sofa again in a neat row while their mother fixed their father another drink of Dr. Horngate's old crow on ice, and used more ice to press against the several very red bumps on their father's face and neck. One of the BBs had pinged him in or near the eye, and that eye was swollen badly, and the skin around it had turned purple and yellow and black. Their mother said, "As long as you're here, you might as well stay and eat. I've got a chicken I was going to bake with some barbecue sauce and some rice and broccoli. I sure would love some fried chicken, if you wouldn't mind doing that," their father said. "Well, I guess I could fry it," their mother said. "It might be quicker, and I know the boys are starving. They were supposed to get some hot tamales." She got the chicken from the refrigerator and cut it up, shook the pieces in a sack with flour and salt and pepper while she heated Crisco in the pan, and soon the boys could smell the chicken frying. They watched from the sofa as their mother bustled about in the kitchen, tending the chicken and starting the rice and broccoli, and as their father sat at the dining table, nursing his drink and pressing an ice pack against his swollen eye. It was all very wonderful and very strange. Their mother moved about in the kitchen's bright light. Their father sat in the dim umbrella of yellow light from the hanging lamp above the little dining table. In the brothers' minds, it was like this maybe wasn't something real. It was like the quiet, weird, clear part near the end of a crazy dream. They could see their father sitting there, but the light was funny, and it was almost like he could flicker out and not be there, and it would only be their mother in there frying chicken. The middle brother felt himself tuning up. Their father then removed the ice pack from his eye and looked over at the boys and smiled and was about to say something when blood began to spout from the swollen eye, and he fell back against the table and cried out, "Jesus God!" Their mother shouted and ran to grab her car keys and hustle their father out the door, calling back to them, "I had to take him to the emergency room." And then they were gone. The boys went out into the carport and watched them drive away up the street. Then they went back into the den. The oldest brother looked dejected, said to the middle brother, "You better go turn off that chicken before it burns up again." "I can cook," the middle brother said. The other two brothers looked at him standing there with a swollen, blood-crusted lip and his eyes swollen from crying, not believing him. And then the middle brother limped into the kitchen and looked into the pan where the chicken was frying, took a fork, turned the pieces of chicken over in the hot oil, and let them cook like that for a while. "Get me a plate and put a piece of newspaper on it and put a paper towel on top of that," he said to the youngest brother. The youngest brother looked at the oldest brother, who motioned for him to do what the middle brother said. So he got the plate and a piece of newspaper and a paper towel that the oldest brother handed to him from the roll on the counter, and he set it down beside the range. In a few minutes, the middle brother took the chicken pieces out of the hot oil and drained them on the plate with the newspaper and paper towel on it. Then he checked the pots with the rice and broccoli. "Get some butter out for the rice and the broccoli," he said to the youngest brother. And the oldest brother nodded for the youngest brother to do what he said. When everything was on the table and they had plates to eat on and forks to eat with, they sat down and helped their plates. The youngest brother said, "Aren't you going to say the blessing?" The middle brother looked at the oldest brother and thought about it for a moment and then said, "No, I don't want to." "All right then," the oldest brother said, and they began to eat.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to Nikki Michaud reading Brad Watson's story, Vacuum. If you like what you're hearing, please support our authors or their heirs by picking up their books on our digital shop at bookshop.org/shop/wordtheater. And be sure to visit our website, wordtheater.org, where you can learn how to become a contributing member. We are signing off for today with the hope that you will read more of this wonderful author, Brad Watson, and remember him always.
Thank you, Jonathan Sachs, for composing our theme music, and Joseph Cho, our technical director. This is Kirsty Pitt in England.
And I'm Cedaring Fox in Los Angeles, signing off.